Words are strange sorts of creatures. Over time, words can, like a larva that is turned into a moth or a butterfly, they can totally change shape, even meaning. Take a word like awful. At one point, awful referred to the state of being in an awareness of God or an awareness of transcendence. So, for instance, entering the temple, she felt the awful presence of the deity. Now, its most common meaning is something like the opposite of that, isn't it? I feel awful. I'm staying in bed today. I feel awful about how I treated you. The word Samaritan is another example. It originally referred to a person who lived in Samaria, the area occupied by the northern kingdom of Israel after it split from Judah. But then, after the routing of the northern kingdom of Israel by the Assyrians, this is the great horror about which Amos warns in our first reading, Samaritan came to refer to those few stragglers who had managed to remain in the land, but who had intermarried with the hated conquerors and occupiers. And thus, Samaritan became a slur, a designation of enemy of Judah. And then, the re-evaluation initiated by Jesus, one of his classic and unprecedented innovations. People who might perhaps love God and their neighbor across traditional boundaries, and who might not be the enemy after all. Much later, the Oxford English Dictionary offers 1649 as the earliest occurrence. There's a further evolution. Now it's not only outsiders who rescue people in need, but anyone who rescues people in trouble. So we hear it on the news all the time. A benefactor within a particular community is referred to as what? A good Samaritan. So now, as this brief survey shows, one of the ironies present with a story like the one Linda just read to us is that we have just as much chance of misunderstanding the parable as the lawyer had in misunderstanding the great commandment, which he quotes so confidently. This lawyer, like some or maybe many of us here today, understands that there's something very different about Jesus. To be around Jesus is to be around someone who at any time, any moment, might say things that, if you're listening carefully, may challenge your view of God, may challenge your view of Israel, we would say of the church, and therefore how you think about yourself. So is it any wonder then that Jesus drew, and still today, draws from people the deepest of questions? The lawyer's may be yours. What must I do to inherit eternal life? You may have different ones. How do I live with suffering? How do I live with joy and gratitude when things don't go my way, either personally or in my family? How do I deal with failure? With habits that are threatening my sanity? What does it mean to live well? Probably, most of us, again like the lawyer, while we live with provisional answers to our deepest questions, we understand, like he did, that we have to take our stand somewhere. So despite all of our doubts and misgivings, we're here in the church. It seems that either intellectually, experientially, maybe simply because of family custom or tradition, Christian theology and ethics seems to be to us a good place to stand and from which to live our lives. Possibly it's the only answer we know, though in a secularizing and pluralizing society, more of us are here than before because we keep making the choice to be here. The lawyer in our story has been shaped by the Judaism of his day, by traditional theology and ethics. Worship God appropriately, be civil, help the elderly across the street, pay your fair share. He's even got his theology and his ethics down to proverbial wisdom. Love God, love your neighbor, and do both of those things passionately. And here's the thing, Jesus isn't against this. Indeed, he affirms it in a very, very strong way. Do this, and you will live. Love God and neighbor, and you'll inherit the quality of existence that is called eternal life. So, boiling down our theology and our ethics to an epigram form is important and helpful. But as Luke notes when he uses the line, "but seeking to justify himself," it can be a dangerous move as well. Proverbs like, "What you do for yourself dies with you, but what you do for others and the world is immortal." Or even the golden rule, "Do unto others what you would have them do unto you." Those things are wonderful, and it can be a wonderful spur to guiding our actions and our decisions. But boiled down theology and ethics can also be dangerous because the particulars are missing. It's become a generalization, and when that happens, I decide the application. Now it becomes possible for the lawyer and for us to decide that helping the elderly across the street is maybe even the totality of what loving our neighbor as ourself means, or that loving God involves in the main being a good person, paying your taxes and not getting into any trouble. But, and here's the rub, what if our boiled down theology and ethics has turned into a justification of our lifestyle? What if our occasional helping of others has become a way for us to justify the excesses in our life, including our hatreds and our prejudices? The test of our theology and our ethics comes out, Jesus says, not in tidy sayings that we've defined, but in how we act towards all people, not just those whom we may help to make ourselves feel better. Here, Amos's stern prophecy and Jesus's point come together. In both cases, the religious establishment was promoting a theology and ethic that justified the mistreatment of some by the importance of its work with others. In Amos's day, small farmers were having their land stripped away. The king's gleanings were oppressive. But you know what those gleanings were used for? To pay for a magnificent liturgy. And the priests supported this. In Jesus' day, the poor were being systematically exploited and not supported by the religious and political leadership. They were considered outside of God's grace. The failure of leadership, both religious and political, meant in both cases that the nation was lying half dead in the ditch. In both cases, horrific judgments ensued. The Assyrians brutally exiled the northern kingdom, and the Romans knocked the temple down in 70 AD and enslaved the majority of the Jews. As Jesus tells the story, he throws in a twist right at the end. You'll remember that the question that spurred the story was, "Who is my neighbor?" Now Jesus asks the lawyer, "Who of the three was a neighbor to the man who fell among thieves?" In other words, who will be the one to overturn the status quo of morality and religion that has decided to help some but not others? Who will be the one to save the nation half dead in the ditch? It takes an outsider, a Samaritan, one of the enemy, to open the eyes of those self-satisfied in their traditions, even though those traditions are double-edged, sometimes damaging. It will be Jesus himself, the true outsider, not accepted by the religious rulers, even as Amos had not been accepted by the priestly and political class of his day. So what can this mean for us? Well, in the first place, I want to say very clearly and boldly that Christ affirms most of our epigrams and proverbs, even a lot of our self-help principles. They're good. One of the most important ones for me in my life has been St. Augustine's, "Love God and do what you please." I'm sure you have your own accounts which amount to your own working theology and ethics. Well, to those things, Jesus would say, "Do this and you will live." But Christ knows there's a bigger, deeper issue, and that's our hearts. And so Christ comes to this place today, not simply to affirm our words, but to transform our hearts, to heal our hearts. Unless our rationalizations that accompany our words are exposed, disease sets in. The Nobel Prize-winning author J.M. Coetzee, his book, Waiting for the Barbarians, is written as a first-person narrative of a judge, similar to the lawyer in our story, coming to a new awareness of his complicity in the systemic injustice that is South Africa under apartheid. And so the novel helps with the shocking realization that large swaths of prejudice are propped up by what appears to be virtue. We're just trying to help those savages fit in, you know? And so we build our residential schools. And in the midst of it, it seemed like a wonderful idea. And indeed, many wonderful Anglicans worked in those schools, unwittingly propping up cultural oppression. What changed things for the judge in Coetzee's novel was his interaction with one girl. With one girl, he experienced her humanity. Her designation as a savage, as a barbarian, was stripped away, and he began to find the courage to shed his rationalizing proverbs. This is the revolution that Jesus inspired. And it would appear as important and understanding as ever. Just the other day, the New York Times articulated what we probably all feel, and this is the quote, "The global mood increasingly feels like one of atavism, of retreat into narrower identities of nation, politics, or sect." The good news is that we can learn to do mercy. The fabulous news is that there is an agent in the universe, the agent who is living from an identity that does mercy all the time, continually, 24/7, and to everyone, everyone. And so in the face of a culture that is rapidly falling victim to the old contagion of narrowness, blame, and revenge, I propose an alliance with this agent, not the spirit of the age, but with the spirit of God. What does it mean for you to cooperate with God in doing mercy, to follow Christ when he says, "Go and do likewise"? The phrase, "passed by on the other side of the road," is also a proverb that has entered our common lexicon, the genesis of which is this very story. I think it's entered our common lexicon because it's still something most of us struggle with. But what about this? What if over the next 30 days, most psychologists tell us it takes 30 days to start a new habit, instead of instinctively keeping our distance from need, we move towards it? Asking the question, Lord, how can I be a neighbor to this person who is in need? I'm betting our perspective on God and ourselves would be filled with difference, with new life and hope. I'm betting the deadening depression of just focusing on ourselves would be lifted. With your help, O Lord, with your help.